given his concerns that the risk it posed to American military and intelligence personnel overseas, you know, he could not support it.
Congressman Young goes against his colleagues in a veto override vote. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Kenai Peninsula residents prepare to vote on electric utility deregulation.
Giving the Homer Electric Board of Directors the ultimate say or the final authority in the direction of the cooperative and the rates we set.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Congress, for the first time, overrode one of President Obama's vetoes. The bill, which now becomes law, allows September 11th victims to sue Saudi Arabia based on allegations that the government there provided support to terrorist attackers. Obama argued the law makes U.S. officials vulnerable to similar lawsuits in foreign courts. 97 senators voted to overturn the veto today, including both Alaskans. Senator Lisa Murkowski said it gives victims and their families an avenue to justice. But Alaska Congressman Don Young bucked the tide. He was one of only 18 Republicans in the House who voted to uphold Obama's veto. His spokesman, Matt Shukaro, says the congressman voted for principle over politics.
Many have made this vote, particularly, this issue about overriding the president and overriding his veto, rather than an examination of the legislation and the policy itself.
In a written statement, Young says he sympathizes with the victims, but says the law allowing them to sue Saudi Arabia threatens national security and the safety of Americans deployed abroad. Shukaro says Obama has taken plenty of actions Young would like to reverse, but he agreed with Obama in opposing this bill.
This was not a vote that he took lightly, but it was something that, given his concerns, that the risk it posed to American military and intelligence personnel overseas and the unintended consequences of this legislation that it poses, he could not support it.
Congress is also on track to pass a short-term spending bill to avoid a government shutdown. Both Alaska senators voted for the spending bill, and the House was scheduled to vote on it this evening. The State Transportation Department has been fined $118,000 for its handling of hazardous waste at a maintenance facility in Juneau. The penalty was levied by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The federal agency alleged the Transportation Department failed to properly identify and label hazardous waste and stored more than 4,000 pounds of hazardous waste without a required storage permit. EPA says the waste includes corrosive liquids, solvents, and petroleum products. Transportation Department spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says department employees did not realize there was a compliance issue until it was pointed out during an inspection. He says the department took immediate action to remedy the situation. Woodrow says there was no environmental damage, including this case. EPA says the Transportation Department has paid about $500,000 in EPA penalties since 2013. Residents across the Kenai Peninsula will soon vote on whether Homer Electric Association can operate without rate oversight from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The utility says deregulation would save time and money and give it more local control, but it would also allow HEA's board to raise rates as high as they want. KBBI's Dasha Eaton has more.
Brad Janorski, general manager for Homer Electric Association, says the vote is about local control.
Local control, giving the Homer Electric Board of Directors the ultimate say or the final authority in the direction of the cooperative and the rates we set.
HEA began the campaign to convince its members to vote yes for local control in late August. The cooperative is the only power provider for most of the Kenai Peninsula, with around 23,000 members. Under the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or the RCA, cooperative utilities already have a lot of local control. For example, they can raise their rates up to 8%, not to exceed 20% in a 3-year period. But Janorski says having the extra step of going before the RCA for final approval of things like tariff changes, line extensions, and more adds an unnecessary layer of bureaucracy and expense.
Somebody asked me the other day, well, what do you think you would save? And I said, we'd save $500,000 a year, easy, just in staff time and attorney's fees. And I had one of the employees I work with who's involved in a lot of these processes looked at me and said, no, it's probably double that.
Janorski says that about 80% of cooperatives in the lower 48 are not regulated. Unregulated electric cooperatives have elected boards of directors that determine policy matters and approve rates and fees. But part of the RCA's job is to look out for ratepayers. That's something Homer resident Mike O'Meara feels strongly about. He was a spokesperson for the HEA Members Forum for years. The watchdog group formed in 2009 to counter the cooperative's efforts to introduce coal power. They were successful, and the group stopped meeting regularly in 2013.
With the issue of deregulation, I've started getting emails and telephone calls from people.
O'Meara is skeptical of deregulation. He says that without the RCA, there would be no consumer protection.
A big part of its job is making sure that ratepayers are treated fairly, that the prices that are charged are within reason, that if there are significant ratepayer complaints, the RCA can intervene.
Mike Pate, also from Homer, was on the HEA board for 22 years, but he resigned in 2009 because he says he felt he could no longer trust the administration. He's a strong advocate for local control, but has reservations about what HEA is pushing for.
I will be voting against deregulation. The final reason that I resigned from the board was I didn't feel comfortable with the quality, integrity of the information that the board was receiving from the administration.
This is a very important deregulation election. I would suggest it's probably the most important deregulation election that the commission has ever been involved with.
That's Bob Pickett, chair of the RCA. Pickett says other utilities have deregulated in Alaska. Matanuska Telephone Utility went independent earlier this year, but they have competition. HEA is a monopoly. HEA claims regulatory operating costs could decrease with deregulation. Pickett says that's very unlikely. He says the cooperative's debt has grown from $172 million to more than $350 million in 5 years. He says that debt is having an impact on ratepayers.
At this point, HEA has, on a per kilowatt hour charge, the highest rates in the rail belt.
Janorski says HEA's bylaws protect ratepayers from unreasonable rate increases. And he says members can trust the board.
You could raise them as high as you wanted, right?
We could. However, they respond to the members.
HEA board members respond to the cooperative members, Janorski says. But he says they also have another responsibility.
Do they have that fiduciary responsibility to their members or to the viability of the co-op?
It is the viability of the cooperative.
The destiny of the cooperative depends on the engagement of the members. If the co-op members feel their board isn't making the right decisions, they always have the option to vote them out, Janorski says. Informational meetings are scheduled for Kenai Peninsula communities in September and October. Ballots will be mailed out in October and must be returned within 30 days. Election results will be made public in December. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the history of the Spanish flu pandemic on the Bristol Bay region.
Just to give you an example, in 1 week, 90 people were dead, and that was just on the Naknek River alone.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The deadly influenza pandemic known as the Spanish flu killed millions of people worldwide, but it hit Alaska particularly hard. Tomorrow evening, an Anchorage lecture will examine the impacts to the Bristol Bay region and how the canneries there helped the local population. The pandemic entered Alaska in 1918 in Nome, Western Alaska, and Southeast. Despite efforts to keep it out of Bristol Bay, it hit that area in 1919. Historian Katie Ringsmith of Tundra Vision organized the discussion along with Tim Troll. Troll is the executive director of the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust. He says when he lived in Dillingham, he was given artifacts from the family of a man at the center of the crisis there, Dr. Linus French.
And particularly looking at some of the photographs after I understood and began to understand the history of the region, realized that we were looking at photographs of orphans, orphans from this flu that struck Bristol Bay in 1919. And just from talking to people in Dillingham and in the region, there is hardly a soul that doesn't have somebody in their family that was an orphan. So their family history comes from, starts in many cases, from the orphans who were then transferred to Conackamack Hospital, still in existence, in Dillingham in 1919. And French was in the middle of it. He was the doctor at Conackamack, founded the hospital, actually.
This disease, you know, came from the trenches of World War I and made its way around the globe, killed millions of people, and then it came to Alaska, and it killed more Alaskans per capita than any other place save Samoa. I mean, just to give you an example, in 1 week, 90 people were dead, and that was just on the Naknek River alone.
Ugashik, Naknek were hit hard, but Igigik had no cases. Is that true?
Right. According to the reports, it was missed. That's one of the strange mysteries of this disease. Just to give you an example of one of the written descriptions, it says, also on this date, a boat drifted near the Alaska Packers Association's Diamondo cannery. Three small children suffering with influenza came to the beach and reported that two men were dead on the boat. The bodies were given burials and the children taken to the Alaska Packers Association's Naknek Hospital, where they recovered and the boat was towed to the NN canneries.
Tim, I wanted to ask about the involvement of the canneries. How did they help in this tragedy?
Commercial fishing in Bristol Bay had already been going on for about 40 years. So it was an entrenched industry. And a cannery was like a small town. And every spring, you know, they'd load up the boats from Seattle, Bellingham, San Francisco, and come north. And typically along with that would be doctors and nurses basically to serve the cannery workers, but also the local natives and the villages that were around. So when they arrived in May of 1919, the flu was already there. I mean, the fear was it would come in with them, but unfortunately, it was already there. And the only government presence that was there at the time was the hospital at Conackamack, now Dillingham. But they were dealing with the problem themselves. They couldn't respond any better. Dr. French himself was sick with the flu. The nurses were sick with the flu. And despite pleas to help, they really couldn't. So the cannery, in this case, the Alaska Packers Association, which was the dominant canning outfit in Bristol Bay at the time, in the state at the time, they were really logistically capable of dealing with it. And, you know, to their credit, they did.
And one of the projects that I'm working on with Bob King and the National Park Service is to try and list the hospital at Naknek on the National Register of Historic Places as a building that can tell this story.
Katie Ringsmith and Tim Troll will discuss the influenza pandemic in Bristol Bay at the Mountain View Library in Anchorage tomorrow evening. Free flu shots will be given starting at 5 p.m. The presentation begins at 6:30. More is at our website, alaskapublic.org. About 4,500 acres of heavily logged forest will return to wilderness under a deal involving the federal government and a Southeast Alaska Native Corporation. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The U.S. Forest Service purchased the acreage near Cube Cove on the west side of Admiralty Island. It's about 30 miles south of Juneau and 20 miles north of Angoon. Just under $4 million was paid to the owner, Shiatica, the Sitka-based Native Corporation. It comes from the Forest Service's Land and Water Conservation Fund. Recreation Lands and Minerals Director James King says the property is surrounded by Admiralty Island National Monument and its Kootsnuwu Wilderness Area.
And this restores the concept of creating an island and a monument that is left relatively intact.
The purchase price covers two of 13 parcels of Cube Cove land owned by Shiatica. The total area is about 22,000 acres, and the full value is about $18.3 million. The once forested area was acquired by the corporation under terms of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. It was extensively logged over an 18-year period ending in 2002. King says the Forest Service may spend additional funds to speed its restoration.
It's possible that as we do further analysis on it, that if we determine to better help the habitat, that thinning may occur, but those decisions have not been made yet.
He says the agency hopes to purchase the remaining Cube Cove acreage, which includes three lakes, over time. But that depends on future federal budgets. Shiatica President and CEO Ken Cameron says the Native Corporation hasn't decided what to do with the $4 million it's being paid. Cameron, who declined to be recorded, says it's on the agenda for a fall planning meeting. He says the corporation understands further sales depend on congressional appropriations. The purchase, announced September 16th, has its critics. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council's Buck Lindekugel calls it a mixed bag.
We're glad that these valuable lands will be back in public ownership where they can heal. It's sad, though, on the other hand, because you know we worked really hard in the 1980s and early 90s to see if we could come up with an exchange so that the Lake Florence and Lake Kathleen could have been returned to public ownership before they were clear-cut.
And Shiatica shareholder Mike Kinville says the corporation shouldn't give up any of its property.
Shiatica is not making what is, in my opinion, sound decisions. To sell our last piece of land concerns me.
The purchase was announced in a joint press release from the federal agency and the corporation. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Bethel has another liquor store. Bethel Native Corporation opened Bethel Spirits yesterday. It's the second liquor store to open this year after almost half-century ban on legal alcohol sales. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur arrived as the doors opened.
So you're the first paying customer?
I'm the first customer, yes.
Cezary Maczynski is a longtime Bethel resident. He immigrated to the U.S. from Poland, and his shop, Cezary's Auto Body and Paint, sits across the street.
I just buy Corona, six-pack Corona for tonight.
Were you planning on being the first customer?
No, I just pull out by my shop because we'd be neighbors now.
What do you think about your shop being neighbors to a liquor store?
I don't worry about it. I never been harassed by drunks. People respect if you respect them.
Maczynski says he's glad AC Quick Stop, Bethel's other liquor store, has competition now, and that this store is owned locally, not in Canada.
I would like to see the money staying here, rather not go over the border.
Right now, there are 8 varieties of beer and 5 varieties of Franzia box wine on the shelves. An 18-pack of canned beer starts at $34.85. A box of wine starts at $37.95. The store is only accepting cash and should be taking debit and credit cards by the end of the week. The store is open Tuesday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. At Bethel Spirits on Bethel Front Street, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. As an Alaskan, you love your salmon, but do you know the things you can do every day to make sure they're here for your children's children? Well, find out what you can do to ensure healthy runs for future generations of Alaskans at salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
For the first time since February, the statewide temperature index for Alaska dipped below normal earlier this week. Sunday and Monday, which were both slightly below normal, interrupted a 218-day stretch of warmer than average temperatures. Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brettschneider told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit the below normal temps didn't last long.
The mid and long range forecast are indicating that we're going to go right back to an above normal situation. So it's a brief respite from the long trend of above normal temperatures.
And when you look at that long trend, what do you see?
Well, we see that there's been a regime shift in the last few years where we've been above normal for the vast majority of time. It's been especially acute this year. So there's really no way to envision where 2016 isn't the warmest for Alaska by a wide margin.
And what do you mean regime shift?
So beginning in mid-2013, June 2013, we saw a shift toward a warmer temperature regime. And there's a lot of reasons why that's happened and a lot of reasons we don't know why it's happened, largely probably results of the Pacific Ocean water temperatures and circulations. But since mid-2013, we've been way above normal for extended periods of time, only broken occasionally by short duration below normal stretches.
And when climatologists like yourself, I mean, when you talk to colleagues who are looking at Alaska and also seeing that, what reaction do you get?
Well, it's a sense of alarm because the Arctic in general is considered a canary in a coal mine with reductions in sea ice, shorter periods of snow cover. The global temperature shifts, global temperature increases are magnified in the Arctic areas. And so what we see going on in high latitudes can be a harbinger of the acceleration of temperature regime changes globally.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk. Do you have a climate question for Brian? Email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. The company that sent the first big luxury cruise ship through Arctic waters is preparing the Crystal Serenity for a repeat performance in 2017. But as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, some experts believe this year's historic transit doesn't mean the Arctic is likely to become a hotspot for global shipping anytime soon.
The cruise ship Crystal Serenity entered New York Harbor Friday morning and sailed into history.
The hoopla over the luxury cruise ship Crystal Serenity's arrival in New York on September 16th after a 32-day voyage from Alaska through the Arctic has died down a bit, but Crystal Cruises CEO and President Edie Rodriguez was still enthusiastic last week as she described what she says was a smashingly successful cruise.
By every standard, a monumental success.
Coast Guard passenger vessel safety specialist Cecil McNutt agrees, at least to the extent that nothing bad happened.
It pretty much went without a hitch.
The Crystal Serenity's cruise would have been unthinkable until recent years when it was made possible by a steady decline in Arctic sea ice due to the warming climate. But sea ice conditions in the Arctic have always been unpredictable, which is why the company went to such lengths to prepare for the cruise, including lengthy consultations with the U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards. But McNutt says ice wasn't a problem this year.
I got some reports from the ship itself, and it showed that the vessel was sailing basically in pretty much ice-free conditions.
In fact, one of the ship's passengers told a reporter they spent much of their voyage looking for sea ice instead of looking out for it. But one of the predictable things about the Arctic is that conditions there are unpredictable. McNutt says that's why rough weather that set in late last month forced the Coast Guard to relocate an evacuation site that was to be used as part of a big field training exercise held to practice rescuing passengers from a cruise ship that had run into trouble in waters off Alaska.
I guess the one lesson learned is that Mother Nature always rules.
And that, says Arctic maritime expert Lawson Brigham, is why the Crystal Serenity's voyage does not necessarily signal the beginning of a boom in cruise tourism or other kinds of shipping in this part of the circumpolar north.
The challenge for using the Arctic Ocean for navigation is that it is, in fact, ice covered. It's ice covered partially or fully, likely 9 months out of the year through the century.
Brigham is a distinguished professor of geography and Arctic policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and a retired Coast Guard officer with years of experience serving in the Arctic. He thinks despite all the talk of a shipping boom in the Arctic Ocean brought on by receding sea ice opening up more shipping lanes, the laws of economics make that unlikely.
It is all about economics.
Brigham says the only type of Arctic shipping that's likely to increase in the years ahead is the kind that brings raw materials out of the region that have become more accessible by the receding sea ice.
The biggest increase in traffic will be the movement of natural resources out of the Arctic to global market.
Brigham thinks that kind of shipping isn't likely to increase much on this side of the Arctic until global prices rebound for such commodities as iron ore, nickel, copper, and hydrocarbons. And even then, he expects the shipping lanes on the Eurasian side of the Arctic Ocean will be busier because there's generally less sea ice along that coastline and because nations there have for decades been building up their shipping and industrial infrastructure.
Where is offshore development? Where is hydrocarbon development? In the Norwegian Arctic right now and in the Russian Arctic, not in our Arctic and not in the Canadian Arctic.
Brigham says receding sea ice may open shorter Arctic routes that may enable ships to get their goods to market more quickly, but that's not guaranteed due to weather and other uncertainties that come with operating in the region. And he says recent expansions of the Panama and Suez canals and other facilities in the lower latitudes suggest investors aren't likely to gamble big sums on the still risky venture of Arctic shipping, at least not yet. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Daisha Eaton in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Annie Fite in Anchorage, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to AlaskaCleanHarbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.